The Bob Siegel Show is brought to you in part by Primetime Advertising Corporation and the law offices of Matthew Simone.
Recurring themes on The Bob Siegel Show can also be found in this Washington Times Communities column, Forbidden Siegel Talk.
It's time now for the Bob Siegel Show, a religious open forum where all questions are welcome. And now, here's your host, Christian apologist, Bob Siegel.
And this is Bob Siegel. So, you'd like to believe in God, but you object to the notion that America was founded for the purpose of being a Christian country. You yourself have heard otherwise, and you're tired of all the historical revision from people like David Barton and others. Well, my friend, I sympathize with you. I do. I sympathize with anyone who opposes historical revision. Here's the question. Which side is the historical revision on? We'll discuss America's past in the high majority of today's program, but first, some observations about America's present, such as the debate last Thursday, quite a feisty debate between some of the Republican candidates. Now, a lot of news, bigger news, has happened since the debate. Michelle Bachmann won the Iowa straw poll. Doesn't legally count toward anything, but it tends to eliminate people, such as Tim Pawlenty, who dropped out. He came in a respectable third. Well, I guess some wouldn't call it a respectable third. He was way behind. Ron Paul came in second. Ron Paul is fantastic with domestic policy. He's a real nightmare with foreign policy, though. And then Rick Perry kind of stole some of the thunder and jumped into the race right on the same day as the polls. All kinds of things are going on. But back to the debate, many quotables, but there's one that I want to key in on. I did this first by writing a piece just a couple of days ago for Washington Times Communities, and it got picked up and tweeted by Fox News, because it defends Fox News. I'm assuming that's the reason they tweeted it. This was the exchange that everybody's talking about between Newt Gingrich and one of the debate moderators, Chris Wallace. But although a lot of people have been playing this and a lot of people have been talking about it, I have a slightly different take that you might find interesting. Let's listen in.
Speaker Gingrich, one of the ways that we judge a candidate is the campaign they run. In June, almost your entire national campaign staff resigned, along with your staff here in Iowa. They said that you were undisciplined in campaigning and fundraising, and at last report you're $1 million in debt. How do you respond to people who say that your campaign has been a mess so far?
Well, let me say first of all, Chris, that I took seriously Brett's injunction to put aside the talking points, and I wish you would put aside the gotcha questions. Like Ronald Reagan, who had 13 senior staff resign the morning of the New Hampshire primary, and whose new campaign manager laid off 100 people because he had no money, because the consultants had spent it. Like John McCain, who had to go and run an inexpensive campaign because the consultants spent it. I intend to run on ideas. Congress should come back Monday. They should repeal the Dodd-Frank bill. They should repeal Sarbanes-Oxley. They should repeal Obamacare. They should institute Lean Six Sigma across the entire federal government. A hard idea for Washington reporters to cover, but an important idea because it's the key to American manufacturing success. I'd love to see the rest of tonight's debate asking us about what we would do to lead an America whose president has failed to lead instead of playing Mickey Mouse games.
Speaker Gingrich, if you think questions about your records are Mickey Mouse, I'm sorry. I think those are questions that a lot of people want to hear answers to, and you're responsible for your records, sir.
Well, if I get a rebuttal,
pardon?
I think that there's too much attention paid by the press corps about the campaign minutiae and not enough paid by the press corps to the basic ideas that distinguish us from Barack Obama.
Now, of course, Gingrich meant it as an attack on bad journalism in general. But again, the recipient here was Chris Wallace, host of Fox News Sunday, and one of several panelist moderators in Thursday's Iowa debate, which was kind of a cartoon before Saturday's main feature straw poll. The debate was co-sponsored by Fox News and the Washington Examiner. Okay, well-intentioned people can argue about the fairness of the question or the over-defensiveness of the response. Some will applaud, as the audience did. They'll applaud Newt's fierce, unapologetic willingness to take on today's media. But if we put some emotion aside for a moment, another golden little nugget of interest gets uncovered. Without a doubt, Gingrich would have given a similar response to any CNN or MSNBC moderator, but the fact that Chris Wallace represents Fox News presents us with an interesting observation. Fox, after all, is frequently accused of being in the tank with conservatives, and they are supposedly an organization with strong right-wing bias and talking points disseminated behind the scenes from the Republican Party. Pay no attention to that man behind the curtain, Larry King. And Larry King's a nice guy. What's the question? Larry King, nice guy. But even he said once of Fox that they're a Republican brand. They're an extension of the Republican Party. He said that in an interview that he gave a while ago to the Chicago Sun-Times. And he did go on to admit some exceptions, such as Greta Van Susteren. Actually, Larry, there are many exceptions. Geraldo Rivera in Fox News articulates very liberal policies, mostly on domestic issues. He leans a bit more conservative regarding the war on terror. Bill O'Reilly is an independent. He's conservative on some subjects, more liberal on others, such as the death penalty. Chris Wallace himself is a registered Democrat, but his politics are undetectable while doing an interview. He asks tough questions to Republicans and Democrats alike, Thursday night serving as a great example of the former. Nobody will ever confuse Alan Combs or Bob Beckel for a conservative. Juan Williams considers himself moderate, but expresses many liberal viewpoints on the panel shows. He is still a believer in honest debate, to his credit, and got in trouble with his former employer, NPR, for politically incorrect statements about airport security. Now, true, on programs such as Hannity, we often see one liberal with two conservatives on a panel of three, four if you count Sean himself. It would be nice to have it more fair and balanced, as Fox likes to claim. Fair and balanced as it once actually was on the older offering, Hannity and Combs. Still, there's a difference between hard news shows and news analysis programs. With hard news, Fox can defend its reputation well. All hosts averaged out, the editorial branch of Fox still tilts to the right, but to say that the other news networks swing vigorously leftward is to make the understatement of the century. By way of example, just take your pick: Bush, Palin, Bachman, Tea Party. The expressed viewpoints regarding such people are just a tad bit on the unflattering side if you hear it on CNN or MSNBC or ABC. Now, not that these mainstream quote-unquote networks view themselves as being too liberal. No, they don't view themselves as liberal at all. They view themselves as editorial positions that can be defended as the moderate, common sense views that any thinking American ought to have. Unfortunately, what many fail to remember is that the middle keeps moving to the left. The right, with the exception of a few nutcase organizations, the right tends to stay where it is, but compared to the shifting middle, the right looks more and more like extreme right. For example, regarding moral standards, what do conservatives believe today that previous conservatives would not have believed 40, 50 years ago? And most moderates would not have believed 20, 30 years ago? Oh, some will argue that with certain issues, better and more progressive information has been obtained. Be that as it may, the right is not shifting. The center is shifting. The center is not very centered. In any event, thank you, Speaker Gingrich, for vindicating Fox News. That may not have been your intention, but to anyone watching carefully, it was certainly the result. While observing, Mr. Gingrich, your reaction to Wallace, it was easier to notice all the other tough questions that came out that night, tough questions about war, gay marriage, the economy, and the personal, sometimes inconsistent, records of each candidate. Who could have viewed this interaction and then gone away with the notion that Fox News operates under Republican talking points? I mean, really, such an interpretation would be a talking point of its own. Well, The future of our country is up for grabs. Now Rick Perry has also thrown his hat in the ring. Just watch. The criticism has already begun, but watch for it to get worse. After all, the man has the audacity to hold prayer meetings. Yes, prayer meetings, as if that somehow violates our establishment clause. There is no hope for the future of America if we're going to historically revise the past of America. This scripture that I'm about to read to you was written years ago, centuries ago, in the days of King Solomon, as a matter of fact. It had to do with ancient Israel, but it still says much about the fact that God not only deals with individuals, he deals with nations as well. The Bible has just as much to say about God and nations as God and individual people. I'm reading from 2 Chronicles 7:14. God talking, by the way. He says, "If my people who are called by my name will humble themselves and pray and seek my face and turn from their wicked ways, then will I hear from heaven and will forgive their sin and will heal their land." I remember when I was in college, we did a special musical presentation at our church based upon that passage. The musical was called If My People. There's a beautiful song which goes with this passage. Now, I hadn't heard it for years. I recently became reacquainted with the song. It's sung by a local San Diego artist named Fred Falduti. But before Fred sings, Fred has some interesting things to also say. Let's listen to both his message and his song.
Suppose our civilizations were destroyed and our cities laid completely in waste. Suppose in 20,000 years an archaeologist from another society were poking around the ruins of your city. If he could dig up just one penny, he would know this about us. The coin is made of a blend of metals. That would tell him that we were miners and knew the science of metallurgy. By the shape of the coin, a perfect circle, he'd know that we understood geometry. The wheat on the back of the coin would tell him that we had been a great agricultural country. He'd know that we'd considered our fine crops a major source of our wealth. The date on the face of the coin would show him that we understood arithmetic and that we had a calendar. The portrait of Abraham Lincoln would mark us as artists who had an advanced culture. The words United States would let him know that we were a federated group of local communities bound together by a strong central government. The phrase E Pluribus Unum would tell him we were scholars who knew foreign languages. The word liberty, right on the face of the penny, would let the archaeologist know that our country sought to guarantee freedom. Freedom for every man. And finally, that phrase In God We Trust would tell him we had a moral law. It would let him know that we had grown strong and mighty under God's great hand. Then, considering the penny, he might very well ask, why did they ever go astray? If my people, which are called by my name, shall humble themselves, and pray. If my people, which are called by my name, shall seek my face and turn from their wicked ways.
ourselves, shall humble themselves and pray.
As if you haven't figured it out by now, Bob is mildly opinionated about the ultimate issues of life. But Bob also respects the opinions of others. To offer your own viewpoint or to challenge Bob with a thought-provoking question, give us a call at 1-888-344-1170. 1-888-344-1170. You can also reach Bob through Facebook, Twitter, or questions@bobsiegel.net.
You know, it's interesting. I've had atheists on this program, atheists that I've done formal debates with, atheists that I've done informal debates with. And I consider myself a friend to atheists. I was an atheist for many years, did not grow up in the church. So I relate to the way they think. I appreciate the rational questions that they sometimes ask. I have noticed, though, that as the years go by, and I think this is due to the internet. I think people are going to the same websites and getting the same talking points. I'm hearing the viewpoints of atheists the same. I used to hear variety. Certainly they were all objecting to Christianity and God, but I heard a variety of objections. Now I hear the same coined phrases. Now you may be an atheist out there and maybe you're very original in your thinking and maybe you don't do any coined phrases. So there's always exceptions and I acknowledge the exceptions. But as a general rule, I'm hearing some of the same things. For example, years ago, it was, well, Jesus Christ lived, but he was just a good man. He certainly wasn't God or the Son of God. He didn't do anything miraculous, and there is no God. Now, what we're hearing from atheists is that Jesus didn't even live at all, that Christianity was this religion that swiped some ideas and myths from Greek mythology and other religions of the time and just created Jesus. Well, another thing that we hear quite common today is not only a historical revision of who Jesus was, but a historical revision of America. We're starting to hear, well, our founding fathers were not really Christians, or not as many of them were Christians as we thought. A couple of weeks ago, I read a letter from an atheist, a woman named Grace, who made that point. And I responded to that, but I want to respond to that in much more detail today. Now, it's interesting because whether or not we're really a Christian country, and that's the question we're going to deal with today. Is America a Christian country? Was it founded to be a Christian country, or was it founded to be a secular country? Very interesting question. But the answer to that question, supposing we proved that America was meant to be a secular country, I don't believe it was meant to be, but supposing that was proven, that wouldn't say jack diddly squat about whether God exists or whether Jesus exists. They could prove that none of the forefathers were Christians. All that would mean is that the forefathers weren't Christians. So it is interesting, though, that in the zeal to say that God doesn't exist or that Christ didn't exist, people are also trying to say that our founding fathers, many of them, were not Christians. And even the ones that were Christians, they say, did not intend for America to become a Christian nation. Now, on the other hand, it sometimes works the other way, like Plan 2. If you get an atheist to admit that a certain founding father was a Christian, well, yeah, he might have been a Christian, but he also held slaves. How's that compatible with Christianity? Okay, that's a very important subject, but I did a whole show on that just a month ago. You can go to my website, and it's archived, and I talked about the fact that there were founding fathers who owned slaves but were tortured over the institution, and a lot of them changed, and a lot of them grew, and none of that justifies slavery. But the fact that slavery did not reconcile itself with their Christianity was a tension that human beings struggled with in those days, just as human beings struggle with tensions today. between their Christianity and their lack of morality on other issues. But today I want to tackle this question of, was America set up to be a Christian nation? I'm going to give you an answer that's going to sound like I'm running for public office, but I'm not running. Of course, when someone says they're not running, that always means that they are running. When I say I'm not running, I mean I'm really not running. I'd love to say, I'll run if the American people want me to run, if I feel I can serve the American people. Anyway, I'm not trying to serve anybody. I don't want to run. I am going to sound like a politician, though. If I run a panel such as the Iowa poll, saw straw poll the day before, and they said to me, Mr. Siegel, do you believe America was set up to be a Christian country? I'd say yes and no, okay? Because it depends on how far back in our history you want to start with. American history existed for over 100 years before we had a constitution and a country called the United States of America. What the original colonies that came from England intended to do and the nation we ended up being 100 years later are different. Now, let's back up. Some basic historical review for some of you. The beginnings. The first English colony, 1607, was Jamestown, as you probably know. Now, that one was not meant to have much to do with Christianity. That was started for economic reasons. Now, there was an Anglican church, a Church of England, established to meet spiritual needs, but that was kind of an afterthought. That was started because this was just going to be good for the nation of England financially. However, not long after that, a group of people called Congregationalist Christians, who had been persecuted for their religious views in England, were given permission to come to America, and they did start a colony at Plymouth, Massachusetts, 1620. By the way, a number of years ago, I was on one of my evangelism tours, and I got some time off, and I got a chance to borrow somebody's car and drive through the backwoods of Connecticut and Massachusetts, and I actually got a chance to go out to Plymouth Rock. I always thought Plymouth Rock was this great big reef. Did you know Plymouth Rock's just this little rock, like a rock you could hold in your hands? And they have these great big Roman columns that you'd look down through, and like an archway, and you look down. And I guess when they say rock, they mean the first stone some pilgrim stepped on. I always thought Plymouth Rock was a big reef. So that it was, boy, it was very anticlimactic. But I enjoyed the drive. Beautiful country. Wouldn't it be fun to go out there and celebrate a Thanksgiving in Plymouth Rock? Well, that turkey would be bigger than the rock. Anyway, having said that, the Congregationalists did, unlike the Jamestown colony, they did come over here for the purpose of religious freedom. And their attempt was to establish a religious community. They made no bones about it. They actually called it a new Zion in the wilderness. That's code for a new Israel in the wilderness. Their government would be the kingdom of God on earth. In fact, they actually started it as a separate republic. Now, that wasn't England's idea. The Puritans did not consider England authoritative anymore. England hadn't heard about this, or they heard about it later. There had been a special clause of England's supremacy that was supposed to go into the charter, where England gave them permission to start this community. That clause was conspicuously omitted, so England asked to have the charter back, but there were delays and there were excuses. And England more or less tolerated this. For one thing, they were across an ocean, and colonies were very good for England economically. It was hard to find somebody who would be willing to handle the life of a colonist, the tough winters, the crossings of the Atlantic. The religious nut was always an easy candidate. So the English gave the religious people a wide latitude. Now, what kinds of laws did they have in this early New England colony? Well, there was a covenant community with a special purpose, goals of regeneration and sanctification. I know those are great big words for those of you who aren't Christians. Those are terms for the Spirit of God working in our heart to slowly and better make us better human beings. And they passed laws. And in their laws, they allowed for no diversity of opinion on the fundamentals. They figured if all were regenerate, if all were really born again of God's Spirit, then we'd all believe the same things. Unfortunately, I meet a lot of Christians who still hold to that view today. They say, we have to have unity in the church. Unfortunately, they always define unity as if everybody thought just like me, then we'd have unity. Well, there are certain things we must agree on as Christians, such as the fact that Jesus died for our sins on the cross and he's the way of salvation. when it comes to church government and styles of worship, there's all kinds of things we could have latitude about. So beware of Christians who say you have to do everything just like me. But the Puritans were saying you have to do everything like us. And we'll talk more about that when we return to our question, was America started as a Christian nation, on The Bob Siegel Show. This is Bob Siegel. They say a man's home is his castle. So when it comes to the wiring of your house, you don't want to mess around with some unknown electrician. Instead, do what I did. Call W&S Electric Incorporated. W&S specializes in both contracting and repair. From troubleshooting to remodeling to circuit breakers and fuses, W&S takes a skilled but personal interest in your home at affordable rates. I know the owner, Wayne Klingenhofer, personally, and I can testify firsthand to his integrity. Call 619-447-8785. That's 447-8785 for W&S Electric Incorporated. License number 480-539, W&S Electric. Founded to be a Christian nation, well, 100 years or so before the Revolutionary War, if you're looking at the Plymouth Colony and other colonies, that was certainly the case. The church expected the kingdom of God on earth. The discipline came from the church government, but they believed rightly informed consciences will agree. Separation between church and state was an unheard of idea in those days. The idea to them was that only the born-again Christians would rule. Church and state alike, they said, should be dominated by the saints. A lot of times when we hear the word saint, we think of the Catholic Church, like somebody goes to St. Bartholomew's, or we think of somebody who did a miracle. In the Bible, saint just means anybody who's saved, anybody who's forgiven. So are you forgiven of your sins? You too are a saint. Maybe they'll make a church out of you too someday. Did you know that Harvard was actually started as a school for prophets? A good friend of mine named Kelly Monroe, centuries later, has written a book called Finding God at Harvard, because it was so rare to find testimonies of people who'd given their lives to Christ at Harvard, or at least amongst the upper-ups at Harvard in the education department, the people teaching. There was a problem that the Puritans had, though, and that was the second generation, because habit replaced direct experience with God. And now people were obedient to external laws, but not necessarily having a genuine relationship with Christ underneath in their soul. So the Puritans came up with what they called a halfway covenant for the second generation, which basically said, okay, maybe you don't consider yourself a Christian. We wish you would. But if you're going to live here, you have to at least obey the morality of the Bible. Now, some of you may cringe at that, the morality of the Bible. Listen, my friend, all laws are based on somebody's standard of morality. If it isn't the Bible's standard, it's just somebody else's. Whether it's a humanist standard, humanism is a religion too. Humanism makes all kinds of ultimate statements about human destiny. They try to leave God out of it. There are people that call themselves theistic humanists, but many humanists try to leave God out of it, and yet they make such ultimate statements about destiny that they're very religious. To make an ultimate statement that God does not exist is just as religious as making the ultimate statement that God does exist. And when somebody says that God doesn't exist and they can't prove it, then they are accepting their viewpoint on faith. Anyway, they had this halfway covenant. And under the Puritans, people were expected to be living in a Christian culture, a Christian colony, a Christian country, if you will. That all changed after the Revolutionary War. After the Revolutionary War, a constitution was put together. And although most people in our country were Christians, there were all kinds of different denominations. And the constitution was written in such a way that we weren't going to mandate a state church or tell people which denomination they had to be. Neither did you have to be a Christian at all or believe in God at all. Most people did, but you did not have to. John Wesley, founder of the Methodist Church, and there's a newer version of the Methodist Church today called the Wesleyan Church. He said, you have nothing to do but save souls. So even after the Revolutionary War, even after we now had this freedom from the British, the statement that Wesley had from back in the days when we were under British rule was that the job of a Christian, The job of a Christian in any country is to save souls. Now, that's an easy thing to say when you're living under the king and you have nothing to do with the government and nothing to do with democracy. But now, the governed and the governors are one and the same, because America was set up to be a democratic republic. Now, people like Thomas Jefferson and Andrew Jackson believed that human beings were on the verge of becoming perfect. They believed that there was a moral evolution taking place. Evolution was an idea before Darwin. Darwin came up with a scientific version of it, but there was this belief that man was morally evolving. And Jefferson, Jackson, people like that, thought the day would come when laws would be done away with by what they called an inner check, something in our conscience that would be so acute that we wouldn't need laws anymore. Now, the Methodists took this idea and they ran with it, but they saw the inner check as possible only by the Spirit of God. Still, a difficulty became quite apparent indeed, because this formula, if you will, contained no provision for the guidance of a converted individual in discharging their political responsibilities. Oh, it was assumed that if they could be guided from within and have no need for laws, that that would be ideal. But less and less people were now being converted. And in the meantime, they said, well, how do we neglect the fashioning of wholesome laws, laws from the unsaved for the saved? Ultimately, some were destined to give up the concept of a Christian society. But there was an urgency in figuring this out. The rationalists at first cooperated with religion because they thought religion was good for the masses, but now religion was seen as hindering progress. After the revolution, intellectuals also wanted to win the masses. And so let's look at this whole idea of separation between church and state. Now, you've heard me say this many times on my program, but if you're listening for the first time today, it surprises a lot of people to hear that the phrase separation between church and state is not in our Constitution. Now, obviously, there's a part of our Constitution called the First Amendment that people interpret that way. Here's what the First Amendment says. Here's what all the bugaboo is about. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. That's it. That's it. And there were all kinds of religious practices, including prayer in the public school, that went on for years and years and years. And it changed in the year 1947, many, many years after our forefathers. 1947, a court case called Everson versus the Board of Education. That court said the First Amendment has erected a wall between church and state. That wall must be kept high and impregnable. Well, when courts make those rules, it establishes what we call case law. And so people begin to think of that as a law, as if that law was in the Constitution. They use the phrase separation between church and state. Somebody had coined the phrase once before, Thomas Jefferson. He didn't coin it in the Constitution. Jefferson didn't even write the Constitution. He wrote the Declaration. In what context did Jefferson use the phrase? We'll discuss that when we come back. Looking to build your own website without a lot of cost and trouble? Hi, I'm Bob Siegel, here to tell you about Web Studio. Web Studio allows people to create their own websites simply and easily without knowing HTML. With Web Studio, you avoid the learning curve of front page and the expense of a web designer. Web Studio has 14 different galleries that contain graphics, sounds, and everything else you need. For more information about Web Studio, go to webstudio.com. Believe in giving credit where credit is due. So this discussion I'm having with you on, is America a Christian nation? Of course, I did a lot of research from many different sources, but two that I want to point to. One might not surprise you. David Barton, who's written many books on this subject, does a wonderful job. He's been a guest on this program. But also a fellow named Winthrop Hudson, who wrote a book called American Protestantism. A lot of the stuff about the early colonies, I want to give credit to him. anyway. I mentioned before we went to the break that it wasn't until the year 1947 that the phrase separation between church and state was bandied about. And I mean bandied about in a popular way, so popularly that a lot of people think the words are in the Constitution. Now, the court in 47 didn't pull that out of thin air. They were referring to a letter Thomas Jefferson had written. And in that letter, he is referring to the First Amendment. He is referring to the Establishment Clause. He used it in a letter that he wrote the Baptist churches of Danbury, Connecticut, who were concerned that the federal constitution might begin to limit the rights of the church. And the fear went something like this. If the government was granting, see, they liked the fact that the government was granting religious freedom, but then people started thinking, well, yeah, I'm a little uncomfortable with the idea that the government is granting it, that the government grants anything. If the government feels it's theirs to grant, maybe someday they'll feel it's theirs to take away. Maybe the government will remove religious freedom. So the Danbury Baptists were asking Jefferson, who'd recently come into office as the third president of the United States, they were asking him to affirm their religious rights as inalienable rights before God, rather than privileges which the state invented. Jefferson agreed with them, and he wrote this letter on January the 2nd, 1802. He said, "Believing with you that religion is a matter that lies solely between man and his God, that he owes account to none other for his faith or his worship, that the legislative powers of government reach actions only and not opinions, I contemplate with sovereign reverence that act of the whole American people which declared that their legislature should make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, thus building a wall of separation between church and state." Get that? Jefferson is using the phrase separation to agree with the Danbury Baptists that they are free before God to practice their religion as they fit. Folks, this doesn't mean you're not supposed to mention the word God outside of a church wall. I mean, it's gotten so ridiculous today. What's going to happen? Somebody sneezes, somebody says, "God bless you," and then the American Civil Liberties Union is going to sue them? Didn't mean that you couldn't pray or read the Bible at the public school. It didn't mean that originally. It's meant that since Everson and the Board of Education and some cases that followed. This is absolutely crazy. You need to remember there had been a time in Europe where religion was mandated. Different countries in Europe declared which brand of Christianity they were going to be. Obviously, Italy was Catholic. Much of Germany was Lutheran. And you get to places like Geneva, Vienna, where they declared themselves to be Reformed following the teachings of Calvin. England, it was the Church of England. And so here in America, we had all kinds of different denominations coming from different countries, not just England, but other countries. And the idea is here in America, we're not going to declare which brand of Christianity you have to be. Neither do you have to be a Christian at all. You can be Jewish. You could be of another religion. You can be an atheist. But that didn't mean that the only place we're allowed to discuss religion is inside the church. I'll never forget a number of years ago, I was out at SUNY College in Albany, New York. And this is something I used to do quite a bit on the college campus. We call it open air evangelism. It wasn't a preaching thing. I was in the quad for about 2 hours and I was very visible. And it did reach people who wouldn't come to an event if you invited them. But I was only taking students' questions about Christianity. People'd say, how can a loving God send people to hell? Or how can a loving God allow suffering in the world? Or what about all the people that lived in Ungabunga and never heard about Jesus? How can you dare say Jesus is the only way? Doesn't the Bible have contradictions? Questions such as that. Well, of course, when you're out there in this free speech area where anybody's supposed to be allowed to speak, you find out on some of our universities that freedom of speech means you can express anything that the university wants you to express. And there were some people that went in and they complained. I didn't know this because I was so caught up in what I was doing, but the student group campus ambassadors who had sponsored me, and you usually have to have a registered student club before somebody like me can come out to a campus as a guest speaker. These students were approached, and of course they'd gotten permission. They had a little yellow slip, and several times somebody would come by and say, "Do you have permission to be here?" And they'd show them the yellow slip. And then somebody else would come by and say, "You have permission to be here?" And they'd show them the yellow slip. Eventually the campus police came and said we had to stop because we were blocking the flow of student traffic. Now, those students testified to me that there have been all kinds of other events, political events, gay activist events, where it was extremely crowded, far more of a blockage. And nobody was really blocking anything. I saw it. Students were walking by. But it's really interesting. And technically at our universities, even a religious person is still allowed to use the free speech area. But boy, you go to our public schools, elementary schools, high schools, they might be able to have some voluntary Christian club during lunchtime or after hours. But there had been a time when teachers could lead students in prayer. Now, how do I feel about that? I have no problem with it whatsoever. In fact, when I was a little kid, there was much more of an open talk about Christianity in the public school. And I was Jewish. I remember I had a fellow on my radio show a number of years ago. I had debated him publicly. We also had him on the phone for a radio debate. Very nice guy. Very nice guy. That was Mark Thomas. We were talking about the public school. And Mark says, well, Bob, you've probably forgotten what it's like to be in school, or maybe you don't know what it's like to be in school and not be a Christian. It feels so intimidating. I said, Mark, I was raised as a Jewish atheist in the culture of Judaism, but it wasn't even religious Judaism. I was an atheist, and students used to be dismissed for catechism, and I didn't quite understand what all that was about. And we had Christmas trees, and we had manger scenes, and we sang Christmas carols that talked about Jesus, not just Rudolph and Santa Claus. And I didn't believe that stuff when I was a little kid. And as I got older and went into junior high and high school, I still didn't believe that stuff. I thought anyone who believed that was stupid. I thought anyone who believed that was an idiot. But you know what? I didn't get bent out of shape that they believed it. Who cares? Folks, I've looked at this from both sides of the coin. Who is being hurt if somebody expresses their faith? Did you know that there are cases where people who've worn a cross around their neck in the workplace have been accused of religious harassment? Did you know there's places where at Christmas time, if somebody wears a red sweater and they're a teacher, they say that's a Christmas color so you can't wear it? It's just gone nuts. Now, let's get back to this question. Were our founding fathers really Christians? I said at the beginning of this show that we don't want to have historical revision. Is America a country that was set up to be a Christian country? If you're talking about the America that existed before the Revolutionary War, depending on which colony, with most colonies, yes, particularly in the Massachusetts, New England places, it was designed to be a Christian colony. Pennsylvania, the Quakers would be another example of one. After the Revolutionary War, we were meant to be a secular government, but it was assumed that our Constitution was based upon Christian principles, and our founding document, the Declaration of Independence, based upon Christian principles. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal and endowed by their Creator with rights. Creator rights. Where do you think human rights come from? If there is no God, there's no such thing as right. There's no such thing as wrong. If there is no God, we're here by randomness and chance, and human beings just make up what is right. If there's a God, there's really such a thing as human rights. Well, today, part of the spin is that not only did the founders not intend for us to be a Christian country, but most of the founders weren't even Christians. Okay, let me go down the list here. 56 founding fathers had seminary degrees. Generally, the signers of the Declaration, signers of the Articles of Confederation, and then the Constitution, which replaced it, and those who went to the first federal Congress, those are the founding fathers. I know it's big in the news that Michelle Bachmann called John Quincy Adams a founding father. You don't even have to count him, but these were the people that everybody would agree are founding fathers. Some of them were at more than one function, so we're talking about 238 slots, but 204 men. 204 of these men were religious. 88 of them were either Episcopalian or Anglican. 30 of them were Presbyterian. 27 of them were Congregationalist. 7 of them were Quaker. 6 were Dutch Reformed or German Reformed, 5 were Lutheran, 3 were Catholic, 3 were Huguenot, that's the Reformed Church of France, 3 were Unitarian, 2 were Methodist, 1 was Calvinist. Now, I always hear that Ben Franklin and Thomas Jefferson were deists. What's a deist? A deist is a person who believes that there is some kind of creator, but he doesn't get involved with human affairs. He doesn't answer prayers. He doesn't have a plan for your life. He kind of winds up the universe like a great big watch and then sits back and watches the watch run. We're Ben Franklin and Thomas Jefferson deists. I wouldn't mind if they were, but they actually weren't. Ben Franklin did call himself one, but he really wasn't. Thomas Jefferson ever even called himself one. I'll elaborate when we return to the Bob Siegel Show.
If you enjoy listening to The Bob Siegel Show, check out Bob's daily blog on townhall.com. Bob is also a regular contributor for San Diego Rostra and San Diego Newsroom. And don't forget his website, www.bobsiegel.net. Here, you download past radio shows, read Bob's many articles about Christianity, and get information about Bob's books. That's www.bobsiegel.net. BobSiegel.net.
Back to our program. Hey, we're always hearing that Ben Franklin and Thomas Jefferson were deists. Now, Franklin did admit to being a deist. He was raised as an Episcopalian. In fact, in 1747, he came up with a plan of education for public schools in Pennsylvania, where he insisted that the schools teach the necessity of a public religion and the excellency of the Christian religion. He also pushed for paid chaplains in Congress. But in 1792, he wrote a letter to a certain Ezra Stiles, and he expressed, quote-unquote, doubt as to the divinity. He doubted the divinity of Christ. And in his autobiography, Ben Franklin wrote the following. He said, some books against deism fell into sermons preached by Boyle's lectures. Fell into my hands, he said. They were said to be the substance of sermons preached at Boyle's lectures. It happened that they wrought an effect on me quite contrary to what was intended by them, for the arguments of the deists, which were quoted to be refuted, appeared to be much stronger than refutations. In short, I soon became a thorough deist. So he's saying people gave him books against deism, and it converted him to deism. So again, a deist is somebody who believes there's a God, but God is not involved in human affairs. So yes, Ben Franklin called himself a deist. The problem is, as Mr. Franklin's life moved forward, he said things about God that a real deist wouldn't say. For example, he wrote in 1730, the deity sometimes interferes by his particular providence and sets aside the events which could otherwise have been produced in the course of nature or by the free agency of man. Now, he said that early on, 1730, but at the Constitutional Convention, which was much later in his life, he says, the longer I live, the more convincing proofs I see of this truth that God governs in the affairs of men. Okay, well, if God's governing in the affairs of men, that's not you're not really a deist anymore. So Mr. Franklin claimed to be a deist, didn't really live like a deist. George Washington was an Anglican. He gave a speech on May the 12th, 1779, about what children needed to learn. Mr. Washington said, above all, what children need to learn was the religion of Christ. On May 2nd, 1778, George Washington said to his soldiers at Valley Forge, and I'm quoting, to the distinguished character of patriot, it should be our highest glory to add the more distinguished character of Christian. When Mr. Washington resigned his commission as commander-in-chief of the military on June 8th, 1783, he said, without a humble imitation of the divine author of our blessed religion, we can never hope to be a happy nation. He was warning us that we cannot be the nation we want to be without God. Washington's own adopted daughter declared of Washington that you might as well question his patriotism as to question his Christianity. Now, what about Thomas Jefferson? He's the other one that's always called a deist. He was raised as an Episcopalian and never once called himself a deist. He called himself a Christian. And he said, I am a real Christian that is a disciple of the doctrines of Christ. Now, I know we always hear about the fact that Jefferson created his own version of the New Testament, that he tore out the miraculous stories and kept in just the teachings of Jesus. That is true. But he did that to use it as a primer to convert a certain tribe of Indians, the Kaskaskia. This is a hard one to pronounce. The Kaskaskia Indians. You just try saying that three times. Kaskaskia Indians of Illinois. I should have just said Indians of Illinois. It would have been a lot easier. Anyway, he did it to convert them so that they could learn the teachings of Christ and they could learn about Christian morality. And he also signed a treaty with them that would make it possible to send more missionaries. How much he believed that we shouldn't lean on the miraculous teachings of Christ is somewhat debatable. It looks like Jefferson probably didn't believe all those things. But that's not quite the same as being a deist who doesn't believe that God isn't involved in human affairs at all. Now, John Adams, a couple of weeks ago, I read you a letter from somebody, an atheist who wrote my radio show, and she says, as President Adams stated, the government of the United States of America is not in any sense founded on the Christian religion. The problem is Adams never stated that. That was from the Treaty of Tripoli in 1797. That was passed right before Adams came into office and technically signed by Adams. And so he would have agreed with those words. But saying that America is not a Christian nation, what Adams meant by that is we do have a secular government. He did not mean to say that we were not a nation influenced by Christian morality. When asked more specifically about it, Jefferson said this. And he said this in a letter to Thomas Jefferson. The general principles on which the fathers achieved independence were the great general principles of Christianity. I will avow that I then believed and now believe that those general principles of Christianity are as eternal and immutable as the existence and attributes of God, and that those principles of liberty are as unalterable as human nature. What about other signers of the Constitution? We're always hearing about, Thomas Jefferson and John Adams were out of the country when the Constitution was put together. They were signers of the Declaration of Independence. But there were signers of the Constitution that you don't hear about as much. They're not the big people. They're not the big forefathers. You're always hearing about Washington, Jefferson, Adams. You may never have heard of Charles Pinckney and John Langdon, but they were signers of the Constitution. They were also founders of the American Bible Society. Now, why is it that we kind of revere these men and then we get freaked out when Governor Perry holds a prayer meeting? And you can just bet that the Democratic spinmeisters will go through that again and again to vilify him and say that he's somebody who blurs our First Amendment. But boy, when Hillary Clinton says she thinks Jesus would have been all for illegal immigration, that somehow is not a blurring of the government and Christianity at all, is it? See, people just cherry pick the issues. Anyway, another signer of the Constitution, James McHenry, founder of the Baltimore Bible Society. Rufus King helped found a Bible Society for Anglicans. Abraham Baldwin, and I don't believe he's any relation to Alec Baldwin. If he is, they have very different beliefs. Although one of the Baldwin brothers actually became a Christian. But this is an Abraham Baldwin, a chaplain during the Revolutionary War and considered the youngest theologian in America. And then there's Roger Sherman, who I think some of you have heard of, William Samuel Johnson, John Dickinson, there's a big name, Jacob Broom, also theological writers, James Wilson, and William Patterson, placed on the Supreme Court by President George Washington. They had prayer over juries in the United States Supreme Courtroom. Okay, well, I'm, of course, just scratching the surface. There are all kinds of books. I'd like to recommend the book Original Intent by David Barton. It's a great read. And next week, we will move on to some other subjects. We're entering the political season, but on the Bob Siegel Show, it's sometimes politics, it's sometimes Christianity and its relationship to politics and pop culture. But whatever it happens to be, you are always welcome. Your questions are welcome, too. We will see you next week.
Bob Siegel Show on KCBQ is sponsored by Bob Siegel.